Good afternoon. Thank you so much for being here. This is the kind of material that I teach in my first year seminar and also in my honor seminar. So it's a little bit different from my research, but it is a topic. The Tale of Genji is something that, as a art historian of Japanese culture, you cannot avoid. And if Will Gardner is here, he can also tell me how he also teaches it in literature. And so it is really my pleasure to be able to talk on this material today. And I have a lot of props today, including two full translations of this text, which was written in the very beginning of the 11th century. And this is a full translation from 2001. This is a full translation that just came out July of this month, this year. And both very interesting, and I'll be able to touch on how they're a little bit different in the coming slides. But this is actually the most recent one, is now the fourth. So there's four full translations in English. This text is something that was written in classical Japanese, so there are also numerous modern translations in Japanese as well. And this is a text that was written by Murasaki Shikibu, who is the lady-in-waiting that I have on the screen. She's the woman on the left. And this is a portrait of a Heian lady. And a Heian period is the period from the late 8th century to the early late 12th century. And it's called a Heian lady. And it's at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. And I think the PMA people consider this to be Murasaki Shikibu, the author. There are many, many portraits of Murasaki Shikibu that have been made and that survive today. And the text, which sadly we don't have the original of, also has been passed down through multiple copies. And as I am showing you to the right, it's 54 chapters in all. And it is a story that has been enjoyed over the past millennium. And there has been according to a diary entry dating from 1008, that's the first mention of this text in historical records. And so you can imagine that in 2008, there were numerous exhibitions celebrating the Genji millennium, so to speak. And there were many exhibitions showcasing the visual arts surrounding this book. And Murasaki Shikibu, the author of this tale, was born to a kind of a middle-level aristocratic family, so she didn't really have the political support, but she had the education and wit to serve the empress at the time. So she was in a very central part of the imperial culture at the time. And also, for a woman at the time, she was also educated by her father in Chinese classics. So she had this amazing range of knowledge, both in Japanese and Chinese literature, that she demonstrates in this Tale of Genji. If you go to Amazon.com and if you look for this book, there's a quote. And this is a quote from Ian Buruma, who reviewed this translation in The New Yorker. So he says, Murasaki, our author, watched the sexual maneuverings, the social plots, the marital politics, the swirl of slights and flatteries that went on around her with the keen, sometimes sardonic, and always worldly eyes of a medieval Jane Austen. So hopefully that kind of gives you a sense of what Murasaki is doing in these 54 chapters. So she was right there in the center of the court. And this is a 54 chapters fictional story, a courtly romance, but that really is based on this keen observation that is demonstrated here. There are more than 430 characters, and this story spans nearly three quarters of a century. And in the first chapter, we meet the Shining Prince, Prince Genji, who is the main character. And this is, I'm taking this genealogy from Richard Baring, who is a scholar of Japanese literature. And if you look down right here, you'll see that there's a web of relationships, and there's formal marriages, and there's also sexual relations without issue, and there's sexual relations with issue, and so on and so forth. And so there is this kind of very intricate web of relationships. And as readers, we need this to keep track of who's who in the story. But we're not the only ones, because such genealogies were made from very early on since this tale was made. What we are located in Kyoto, which is Western Japan, and in Kyoto today, there's also, it's very much like New York City in the way this is a gridded layout. And this was the center of universe for the courtiers who inhabited the imperial court at the time. And this is really the location in which the story takes place. And this is a model of the residence of Prince Genji. And this is a polygamous society at the time. So here we have four quarters of residences, all of his wives living in separate quarters, but very close to one another. So you can kind of imagine the kind of gossips and encounters that ensue. In the introduction to the most recent translation, Dennis Washburn notes, one measure of Genji's achievement as art is that, like the Homeric epics or the tragedies of Shakespeare, Genji Monogatari, this tale, has been able to inspire multiple interpretations over a long period of time. He also notes, over the past millennium, readers from vastly different eras and social backgrounds have discovered in its depiction of the culture of the imperial court a profound understanding of human experience that simultaneously resonates with and challenges their own. So in my presentation today, what I'm hoping to do is to show that, you know, not everyone had access to this text, but many encountered Genji through images. And also, these images demonstrate how multiple artists and viewers over time engaged with Genji and also kept Genji relevant to their times. And so I hope to be able to demonstrate this, how the role of images in this reception of Genji. And I'm starting with this image, and I want you to sort of take a moment to see what's going on. This is, I think it's appropriate to start the discussion of visual culture of Genji with this text, with this particular artwork, but because this is the earliest extant example that we have today. It was made about 100 years after the text was written, so it's from the early 12th century. And it's actually a little bit of a deceptive image here, because it's a this was written or made in a form of a hand scroll, which is this rolled up scroll. And as a viewer, you would be unrolling at a time like this. And so this is deceptive in a way, because it has all the parts of the scroll all rolled out for you. And I start with this image also because it truly is the rock star of all Genji representations. It has been featured in stamps. And also part of a section appears in a 2,000 yen bill in Japan. So if you can imagine sort of Greek mythology or Shakespeare, the way that it is part of popular culture today, that's kind of where Genji occupies. You kind of are very aware of it as this great literary classic, and you're familiar with the images as well. I'm also starting with this image because it allows me to show you what a narrative hand scroll looks like. And a narrative hand scroll is one of the most used formats in Japanese art for telling narratives. And you know, I just have this on the screen, but then I want you to fight the urge to read from left to right as you would read Western languages, because everything is going from right to left. The text is written from top to bottom. And this is also allows me to show you that in these narrative hand scrolls, the way of representation is that you would first have excerpts of text, which is then followed by image. So it's text, image, text, image, text, image. And this was the most deluxe set. We believe that it was made for a celebration or a birthday of a retired emperor. It originally consisted of 10 to 12 scrolls, more than 100 excerpts from this 54 chapter accompanying images. But what we have today are just 20 paintings and 29 excerpts. So about one fifth of the original has survived today. And they're dispersed among different collections in Japan. But this is a scroll that gives us a sense of the high, the aesthetics of the time of the 12th century, the kind of aesthetics that courtiers of the 11th century who are discussed in this story also very much cared about. There were about five artistic supervisors involved, and it was kind of like a contest in a way that each of these supervisors were likely assigned 2 to 3 scrolls each. And we have a sense of different calligraphers and the best painters, the best paper makers of the time involved in the production. And I'm showing you a close-up of calligraphy. This is very elegant calligraphy, and also I think you'll notice how densely the paper is decorated as well. So you have very high quality paper. People today can't replicate these techniques. You see a very thin pieces of gold foil that is scattered across the surface. It's really, truly a wonderful piece of material culture that we have here today. It's the oldest extant manuscript version, as I mentioned, and it also describes the scenes that survive today also give us a sense of the deep emotion that is described in this tale. And so since I don't have the time to talk about 54 chapters, I'm going to focus on a narrative arc that goes from chapter 34, 35, 36. And it is a part of the story where Genji is the protagonist. He's at the center. I think he's in his 40s, but he has a child in his very advanced age. And this child is Kaoru that we see down there. So this is chapter 36, and chapter 36 in this national treasure scroll set. Oh, I forgot to mention that. It's a national treasure. It's a Japanese national treasure. And there's three scenes selected to represent this particular chapter. So you can imagine that the supervisors decided that these three images would best represent what is at the core of this chapter. And again, I want you to think about reading these images as you imagine the scroll being unscrolled, going from right to left, and us pausing. So these are the three scenes, first, second, and third. I want you to try to make sense of this. So what happens in this chapter, this is a major spoiler alert, so I'm sorry if you kind of was thinking about reading this tale. But the tragedy here from chapter 34 to 36 is that who we thought was Genji's child is actually an illegitimate child that was born between his official wife, the third princess, and a son of a rival, Kashiwagi. So third princess, Kashiwagi, please kind of note those names. And so Kaoru is in fact not Genji's son. So we have an excerpt here, and then we have this image. And here I'm able to describe one of the techniques that are employed in telling this story in a narrative hand scroll. And this is a technique called the blown off roof. So we are looking at, as viewers, we are seeing the characters in this chapter from the top, and we're able to see the various relationships all at once. So we have the third princess is right here. This is Genji, and then this is third princess's father, the retired emperor, who's come to see her because she has just given birth to this beautiful boy, and yet she wants to, she's unhappy, and she's becoming ill. So here is the emperor visiting her, and Genji is surprised because this is an unannounced surprise visit. And then we have multiple ladies in waiting here in the scene as well. This is the structure of the room. This is another model that shows us what it looks like. So imagine that we're looking in, and this is the main room here, and this is a kind of structure from the 12th century, where you have corridors surrounding these rooms. And one of the things to keep in mind is at the time of the tale, when the tale takes place, the high-ranking ladies were rarely seen. They were always hidden behind these bamboo blinds. So to be able to see a woman directly demonstrates that you're very intimate. So that's something to keep in mind as we look at these images. And here you see the corridors. And so this is giving us a perspective into this scene. And the top image is a photograph. And as you can imagine, photographs, you know, are linear perspective. So you have a set, and so you're kind of looking into this image. And compared to this very organized, stable composition that we see at the top, in the bottom, you see that there are so many lines, diagonal lines, that are cutting through the figures. These are the tatami mats that you see here. These are the standing curtains that you see here. There's multiple of them. And you see also the floor right here. So you have a sense of the scene where these two, who are father and daughter, and Genji, deeply engaged in a very sad moment. This room is filled with tension. And the figures here are rather still. You might kind of look at this image and think that this is it's like a frozen frame from a movie or a snapshot of a moment. But in fact, there's a lot of emotions swirling around in this image. And the figures are just very delicately gesturing. So they're crying, they're sobbing in this scene, and yet they look very still. And in this technique, what's creating this emotional effect is the fact that as viewers, we see the three figures locked in this triangle. He's very confused because he doesn't know what's going on. Genji knows exactly what's going on because he's actually found the letter that was written by Kashiwagi, and he discovers that it's actually not his son. So he knows all this, but he can't tell the emperor what's going on. And the third princess, meanwhile, is saying, "I would like to renounce the world. Please, father, make me a nun." So there's a lot going on here. And so these figures are locked together in this triangular relationship, and yet no one's really talking to one another. I'm sorry. And what is creating this emotional effect is all these diagonal lines, and also the curtains. They are the ones aflutter. They are the ones representing this emotion that is swirling in the minds of these figures. The hand scroll, as I demonstrated, it's something that you move as you go along. So this is a hand scroll of a landscape. And there are two approaches to representing story or telling a story with the hand scroll. And what we've been looking at is the top image, where it's the text and we have a compartmentalized kind of vignette followed by another text. And another approach here is where a text is then followed by continuous events. And so really, as you're scrolling along, you're following the narrative. And this is a really wonderful scene of a fire that breaks out at an imperial palace. So that the Tale of Genji scroll producers chose to take this approach makes sense, because what they want you to do is to stop and look at this image and spend a lot of time doing what we like to call these days slow looking, where you immersing yourself in that moment and in that image. So this is the first scene, and it also helps you to see that the ladies in waiting, much like the author Murasaki, she was one of them, they're always present. So there's not a moment where you're truly alone. You have these figures around you. This is the second scene that was selected for the scroll, and we see Genji's son, Yugiri, visiting Kashiwagi at its deathbed. So this is the father of the child. And again, we see here two figures very close to one another. He's at his deathbed, but it's actually a day where there's a lot of celebration going on because he's just been promoted. So he's at his deathbed because he's dying because he knows that Genji knows what happened. And so he's really, this has made him so terribly ill that he cannot live anymore. And he's kind of wills himself to death. And so we have this moment, and the composition now shows us looking at the two characters, looking at one another, And again, we see a group of ladies in waiting looking in. And Kashiwagi, although he's lying down in his bed, he's wearing an official formal hat to keep face and to allow his friend to come see him. And this is a very important moment in this chapter, because Kashiwagi is suggesting, he's not telling his friend exactly what happened, but he's telling him that something terrible has happened and he must apologize to Genji. So they're close, yet nothing is revealed. And it's interesting because this very intimate scene never gets represented again in visual culture after this scroll. This is a selection of, it's a short passage, so I think it's okay to show this here. This is the text that precedes the third image. And this is the Tyler translation, so allow me to read it out loud. It says, "One or two of her women must know what happened. How I wish she would understand me. But no, to her I probably look like a fool. Never mind my own part in this, though. I feel sorrier for her than for me." Genji's face betrayed none of these thoughts. How do that innocent babbling, those sweet eyes, and that clear mouth look to someone who does not know? The resemblance is very close, though, and to think that he left no more than this pitiful and completely unknown legacy, a child he could never have shown his parents, even though they were no doubt weeping for him to have one. Proud and accomplished as he was, he brought about his own destruction. Pity and regret drove the affront from Genji's heart, and he burst into tears. Should anyone ask who it is who, in his time, cast that seed abroad, what reply will he then give the pine planted on the rock? So, there's a lot of he's and she's, right? And if you're an unaccustomed reader, it's very confusing. Tyler keeps the feel of the original. And the original is very dense, there's no punctuation, and so that there's a whole commentarial culture that annotated line by line. So it's deliberately vague, in a sense. And so let me allow you the new translation. And what the translator has done here is he's really tried to spell things out for us, and it's getting a lot of good reviews, and I think it makes sense. But now you can compare two different approaches. So this translation, he decided to translate the inner monologue in italics, so that we know that what is the inner monologue and what is the dialogue and the authorial voice. So here it says, "There must be someone among her attendants who knows the truth. It's annoying not knowing who she is. And since she has no idea how I feel, I probably look like a proper fool to her. Still, I can put up with the criticism that comes my way. Between the two of us, the third princess is the one more to be pitied." He did not blush or show any expression that might give away his private thoughts. Genji observed the child's innocent babbling and laughter and was captivated by the expression around his little eyes and mouth. I wonder what those women who are unaware of the truth think about his looks. He really does remember Kashiwagi. Genji's thoughts turned to the boy's true father. He left behind this little keepsake that no one knows about, that he couldn't even show to his parents, who are probably weeping right this moment, wondering why he did not at least leave a child behind as a memento for them. To think that such an ambitious and accomplished young man should have destroyed himself. Overcome by pity and remorse, the outrage that had filled Genji's heart dissipated, and he wept. How will the pine rooted in the crags respond should someone ask by whose hand and in whose reign was its seed planted? So a lot of it is spelled out for us. And this is the image that we encounter as after we read that excerpt. We see here Genji, and this is the third princess. He's actually abruptly drawn the curtains on her, and he's in this room holding the baby. And again, there are ladies in waiting. And there's this external space, which we as viewers get to fill with sort of our thoughts about what's going on. And when we zoom into the Genji and the baby Kaoru, we see that their eyes are locked and they're looking at one another. It's interesting because X-ray photos revealed, or infrared photos revealed, that in an earlier version, the painter had chosen to depict the baby's arms outstretched toward Genji. But I think in the final, they decided that it was too much, too explicit. So instead, these are two figures looking at one another. And here I'm also showing you a technique that is used in early narrative painting, which is to represent the figure's faces with lines for the eyes and a hook for the nose. And sometimes this gets criticized for being very kind of bland faces, but in fact, when you look closely, and I want to note that these faces are about the size of your thumbnail, so they're very small images, but you see that very delicate lines in fact show emotion. And this has the task of demonstrating looking and thinking at the same time, right? And also, because the faces are done in this conventional manner, as viewers, we're also able to kind of project our thoughts onto the scene. And so this is the very image, but I'm showing you a 17th century printed version of this text. So you see that there are a lot of text in this particular chapter, but as I've demonstrated for chapter 36 in the 12th century scroll, only sections of it were excerpted. Okay, now let's get to comic book renditions of this very same scene. This is called Asaki Yumemishi. This was a very epic 13-volume serialized comic book that was published from 1979 to 1993. By one estimation, by 1999, there were 17 million copies sold. So very popular. So this very same scene, this is the equivalent of the third image that we just looked at. So this is the celebration. It's the baby's 50th birthday. And there are ladies in waiting talking to Genji, saying, how should we organize this celebration? And there's a lot of dialogue. And the speech bubbles tell you what's going on, or the dialogues that the figures are talking. And then around the head of Genji is the inner monologue. So, and you see that the artist here has also created a lot of frames in different sizes and different shapes. This is the third princess. She has now become a nun, so she still has long hair, but she's wearing dark robes. And Genji is not very fond of her to begin with, and he says, and because she makes very bad decisions. And she, also her manners are a little bit childish, so he's saying here, oh, again, do you really have to come on this 50th birthday in such a dark robe? And so here's the scene where he is lifted up the curtains and talking to her about what's going on. And then there's the baby. And the baby's cooing and awing is done in that in a different style, demonstrating that it's a baby's voice that is speaking. And then here's Genji's inner thoughts. And the background turns black. So he's suffering. He's really suffering. And he's thinking, oh, poor Kashiwagi, and then Kashiwagi's image floats in. And we saw that little poem that was introduced at the end of the passage, and here the author introduces that poem, but she chooses a different type of font to demonstrate that this is an elegant expression and to distinguish it from the other dialogues that are happening. And here, another major spoiler alert, is that Genji realizes that karma is catching up with him because, in fact, he had an affair with his father's consort, and they have an illegitimate child as well, and he's the current emperor. So he's realizing that it has come full circle, and now he turns his attention to his baby. So remember, we were looking at them, looking at one another, but here we see we are occupying Genji and looking at the baby, and lightness, there's light shining through, and he says, yes, I can love this child. And so it's a very happy moment of discovery. And so you see that the background, the type of fonts that are selected, all of these are contributing to this narrative telling. So this is the spoiler where Genji and the emperor, his father, he actually had a child with his consort, and it is the Reize emperor right here. And in the 2000 yen bill, interestingly, they also picked a scene where Genji and the Reize emperor, they kind of acknowledge that they're actually father and son. But again, there is an architectural beam that cuts right through them. So as viewers, we recognize that It is never a relationship that is meant to be revealed. So this is one of the earliest forms of narrative hand scroll. It's a very important format in Japanese visual culture. But a lot of Genji also survives in other formats. So let me quickly go through those images as well to demonstrate the difference in approach. This is an album book. And in this version of the Genji, we have one excerpt, which is then coupled with one scene. So one scholar describes this as a scenographic sensibility, a scenographic approach to representing the narrative, where you experience the narrative primarily as a pictorial sequencing of events, moments, or encounters. So it represents a different mode of reading. And it also produced a kind of compositional template, or what we call iconographies, that allow us to easily kind of identify an image with a chapter. And this is currently in the Harvard Art Museums. And it's from the 16th century. And most likely, although it's in album form today, it was used to be pasted on the surface of folding screens. And the folding screen is, well, you can go to IKEA and other furniture stores today to buy these things. But there were very effective room dividers, but also the very important formats for paintings in Japanese pre-modern Japan. And so we see the text and the image being pasted here. And this is a manual that also has been translated called The Iconography of the Tale of Genji. It's from the 16th century, and it's a painter's manual that tells you, to represent this chapter, here are the motifs that you should use. So you have a sense of this codification happening around Genji. So this is the 36th chapter. We also know from the backing paper that it was a major project involving several courtiers at the time. And here's one scene from one of the images where they're having a picture contest. And these are the three scenes that are selected for chapters 34, 35, and 36. And this is an important image that I want to talk about for a moment. This is the fateful meeting between Kashiwagi and the Third Princess. So as I described, the ladies were often behind bamboo blinds. So men really never had a chance to see these people. But Kashiwagi, although he's never laid eyes on the Third Princess, knew of her reputation, and he had been pining, just thinking about her, and and he has this very lucky moment, unlucky for the Third Princess, lucky for him, where they have a soccer, I shouldn't call it, but it's a kickball match at the palace, where young courtiers are doing kickball, and they're throwing up this ball in the air. The goal is to keep it in the air. And foolishly, the Third Princess's cat decides to run out and lift the blinds. And lo and behold, there's Kashiwagi, and he sees her. And that's really the beginning of the tragedy. So this is my seminar. We visit the storage room of the Philadelphia Museum of Art, because the Philadelphia Museum of Art also has wonderful images from Genji. And here's to give you a sense of scale and the importance of seeing an actual work. And this is, again, a scene from chapter 34, that moment where the cat escapes. And you never see ladies also standing. So this is scandalous, too, that she's standing like this. From about the 16th century, in addition to the album books and also the hanging scrolls, we have hand scrolls. We have folding screens dedicated to Genji. And this is a screen that represents all the chapters of Genji in one pair. And what they did here is they represent each chapter, and the gold clouds separate each chapter. So in a way, if you ordered a Genji screen, you had all the 54 chapters. And some of the chapters were duplicated or represented by different scenes, because if you do the math, if you represent 5 chapters per panel, that's going to be 60, and there's 54 chapters. here's another version, and this is of fan paintings, and this is what a fan looks like. It's, you know, used to keep cool, but also you can be incognito by kind of carrying it in front of your face. But these were also mediums that came to be used to represent Genji. And this is a very clever version and very advanced version, so to speak, because we don't have the chapters ordered by chapter, but rather it depends. It's organized by season in which the chapter takes place. So this is very advanced Genji. And we also have the poems selected from chapters inscribed on them. So it's very cultured for a very specific patron who was very intimately familiar. And so again, we have that image, that familiar image of the kickball scene, the third princess and the cat, and organized by season. So you can imagine that once the Genji becomes represented on the folding screen, this gives the artist really interesting challenge. So how am I going to tackle 54 chapters? And here's an example where this screen typically uses clouds because they're very good devices of kind of bending time and space or not having to describe these things. But instead, this painter decided, I'm going to do away with the clouds and I'm going to try to make every scene fit within an architectural setting. So we have so much buildings and the figures interacting in the scene. The Philadelphia Museum of Art also has screens. And in this case, not all 54, but selected chapters are represented. And so, for example, we have the 34 chapter here in the 54 version, and we have the same image here. So I think you can see how each chapter, there's kind of a conventionalized approach to representing these chapters. Let me see that right here. Now, at the Freer Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., they have a screen that also just zeroes in on that moment. So a whole screen is dedicated to that one chapter. So we have, again, the third princess who is standing up, the cat has escaped, and there's Kashiwagi. And this one is very interesting, where the painter has chosen to draw the bamboo blinds in front of our eyes. And so, are we that close to Genji? Are we forever separated from the world of Genji? It brings a lot of interesting questions. And in my seminar, I just assign a screen to a student. And it's just, I think it's a tough task because I say, read the chapter, look at all the images that have been produced on that chapter for all of pre-modern times, and figure out what's going on in these images. But Swarthmore students, they rise to the task. It's really amazing, wonderful interpretations every year. And this is how a screen is used. It's really a partition, but also it shows who the most important person is in the room. There's also a front and a back. The content of Genji can be a little scandalous because there are a lot of relationships. But Genji becomes celebrated as an artifact and truly respected as a legacy. And so we see the tale of Genji appearing as motifs and also produces sets for bridal trousseaus as dowries. So we have this set from the 17th century made for a princess. Every little object that she took for her marriage is decorated with the tale of Genji. There's these stands to display her books. And these are containers for matching shell games. And this is really for people who had a lot of time on their hands, because this was a game where you are matching the shells, right? It's like you spread it all out. And the really kind of amazing thing is that you're not matching the pictures, but you're actually matching the patterns on the shells, because the shells always have the same pattern on them. So next time you have a clam, take a look, because you know they have the same pattern on them. And so this is, again, so we see the iconography that that has been developed on a particular chapter painted onto the surface. There are also many deluxe books that were produced for these brides for their education and cultivation. Genji becomes a resource for how to behave, how to also reading the text and writing calligraphy, all of these things. And so we have these very deluxe sets that were made. Some were not read, suggesting that, you know, they were there for show, kind of as deluxe sets. They also become patterns on robes. So we have this robe from I would say the 17th century, where we have the Genji booklets being scattered and names of the chapters also embroidered onto the surface. This is a ceramic box from the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and it says The Tale of Genji. It has the books, but it's a box. So it's kind of this commodification of Genji, but also Genji as object. And we see this also in this print from the 18th century, where courtesans are playing a game of incense matching. And we see in the background to demonstrate that they're also cultured and cultivated, so they have stacks of books in the background. The Genji incense phenomenon is also very, very interesting, where 25 packets of incense are distributed, and each player gets five. And you don't smell incense, you listen to incense, and you're supposed to identify which of them were similar or the same. And depending on it, you connect the lines, and each pattern is associated with a chapter from the Tale of Genji. And here we have this Genji booklet that shows you, again, very specific motifs now coming to represent the story. Now I want to also end with some images from popular culture of the 18th century and 19th century. This is the print culture. So if previously you had to have known someone who could make copies of the Genji for you, there are now print editions at this time, and there are also these single sheet Genji images that you could buy for a bowl of, for about the same price for a bowl of noodles. So this is Genji culture becoming part of a growing public. And this is very elegant, where it shows the third princess and Kashiwagi. Were they this ever close outside, just standing by you with each other? No, but here you have the poem that is exchanged between them. It's very elegant. It also just shows classical culture packaged into one, with the elegant clouds, the attire. All of this speaks of this classical bygone time. Here is Genji in contemporary disguise of the 18th and 19th century. Here we see, and so the people are wearing 18th century robes, and this is also taking place at a courtesan's a bordello, and we see Genji, and he unfortunately discovers a letter from Kashiwagi to the third princess, and this is how the whole scandal is revealed. And so we see him at that moment looking at, finding the letter. In this one, we see, although it says chapter 36, we have kind of a mashup of images from chapter 34 and 36, because we see here the third princess, the cat, Kashiwagi holding the soccer ball, and the cat holding the letter in its mouth. So it's all the motifs smushed in one. And we also, as a bonus, have the Genji incense of representing this chapter. So it's interesting that it's actually a lot of the images coming from chapter 34, but chapter 36 is called Kashiwagi, and so these images from chapter 34 become associated with 36. And then we have many images of just the third princess with the cat, and there's many kind of gendered readings that we can do about this, but for now I think we can, I'd like to end by saying that, you know, we are now Genji. Looking at, we're Kashiwagi, not Genji. If only it were Genji. So this is Kashiwagi looking at the third princess, and these portraits were made. So we can also imagine courtesans kind of imagining themselves as the third princess and these images being produced for them. So I heard just yesterday that there's going to be a exhibition of The Tale of Genji at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 3 years' time, fall of 2018. I hope that this has gotten you a little bit interested and that we can maybe go take a tour and through this exhibition together. But now I'd like to stop and entertain any questions that you might have about this visual culture. Thank you.